Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. I'm here, as always, with my two partners in crime. I got Matt Kachansky, retired executive from HHS OIG and the retired Northeast UPIP director, and currently our payment integrity director here at Advise, and his partner in crime, Wade McFall, assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and now working as a manager on our SIU team. It's good to have you guys as always. It's good to see the two of you in the same room with your backgrounds. One of these days you'll come to the corporate office and I could maybe not deal with this laptop, which has all your personal information on it.
Hopefully that's why we're not there.
That's a good idea. It's a good idea. HIPAA, we don't HIPAA violations. So today we want to take a little bit of a divergent talk. We want to talk a little bit about personnel, staffing, and some of the trials and tribulations that are going on right now in the healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse community, both on the federal side and as well as on the SIU side from a payment integrity perspective. You know, you need people to do the work. And the biggest challenge right now is institutional knowledge and the dwindling resources. We're seeing today, recently, we just saw CVS. Aetna has done some layoffs on their corporate side. We're seeing that Optum, United, the BUCAs, the Blues, United, Cigna's, Anthems, we're seeing a lot of reductions in force, or what they call RIFs in the government, that's coming about as the result of just budget constraints. And we're not here to have a conversation about how profits are soaring in the payer community or what have you. We're just here to talk strictly about how, as times change and how priorities change, things occur that will lead to differences in the ability to staff SIUs and the like. So, you know, I think it's important to talk about sort of that transition that occurs oftentimes in government service, where people retire from government service and then they go work in an SIU or an FWA type environment. And so, Wade, you know, you and I both worked in larger regions in the country. I was in New York, you were in LA. And I know that when we were doing a hiring, we would have instances where we would get hundreds of applications, particularly during the period of time when OIG was granted the authority to do something called direct hire, right? In the typical world, our process, even though HHS OIG is a civil service organization, which means it's competitive in the hiring and administrative issues and firing and all of that, when it went to a direct hire process, which has now gone away, and I know there's talk about bringing it back, but in the direct hire process, the regional offices were able to go through, select the resumes of the people they thought were the most qualified, interview them, and then make offers or selections that way. And the number of people that were applying was just astronomical. And, you know, one of the things that we're all kind of collectively seeing is people that are at the OIG that are eligible to retire or either not retiring, because of, you know, sort of some of the difficulties in the job market, particularly in the SIU space, and or people that are looking to leave or have left are believing that their value is substantially more than what they are. And I know you talk to a lot of people at OIG also, but, you know, oftentimes I think that from that OIG perspective, sometimes the challenge in hiring qualified people, and then once you've got them, it's sometimes tough to get rid of them if they don't cut the mustard, so to speak. But talk a little bit about, you know, when you were in ASAC and you were vetting resumes and that, and you're looking for an entry level position to come in, what were some of the things that you'd be looking at when you were kind of vetting resumes?
Well, yeah, there was a couple things that kind of stood out to me. And one was, you really have, like, the first decision is, do you want to bring on somebody with experience, like a lateral transfer from another agency? Or do you want to bring on somebody fresh that you can kind of train? You know, they don't bring as much, I don't want to say baggage, but if they come from another three-letter agency, they, you know, you'll get a lot of the, well, that's not the way we did it at, you know, whatever agency. So there is that. Whereas if you get somebody fresh out of, you know, maybe just out of college, and the learning curve may be a little bit longer because they don't have quite as much experience, but you can really mold them into what you want, I think a little bit easier. So that's like the first step, I guess, is to decide which pool you want to pull from. And then the second thing is, as you said, there's usually, if it's one or two vacancies, you're going to get over 100 resumes for sure. And you know, you're not really going to hire off of a resume. The resume is just the mechanism for them to get their foot in the door to get interviewed. And that's where you really make the decisions, obviously. But, you know, you'll get a lot of, you know, 2-3 page, you know, 4 page resumes sometimes. And if we're going to go through 100 resumes, they really have to stand out. And that's even like I've talked to some people about updating their resume, and you want to assume that the reviewer is not going to read the whole thing, because most cases they're probably not going to. So you want to have those bullet points, the most important, you know, your most important accomplishments or whatever it is that you want to make sure that the reviewer sees. Those have to be right at the top of the page. The first bullet, you know, you have a couple different headings. Don't have, you know, 15 bullets for each heading, because they're probably not going to read all 15. Make sure you have the most important ones at the top, because you just want that resume to make it to the pile of, we're at least going to re-review this, or we're going to call for an interview. And again, when you have hundreds that you're going through, they really have to stand out. And then, like I say, that's really just to get the foot in the door, and where you really make the decision is, how do they interact in person? How do they respond on their feet? You know, what kind of, you have those, not really trick questions, but questions that they're probably not expecting. So you really do get a chance to see, like, they haven't done all this research and have like a prepared statement. It's, they have to kind of think on their feet. So that's really where a lot of the decisions are made, I think, as well.
You know, what's interesting is I remember, you know, we were getting ready to do a hiring for New Jersey, and we were looking to add 1 or 2 people, and I was on the panels for all the hires. And, you know, the interviews are fairly standard. And, you know, one of the questions that we would always ask is, what's one of the greatest challenges that you have in your current job that you've had to overcome? You know, I think that's a standard question. You know, we don't really get into the where do you see yourself in 5 years kind of nonsense that sometimes people ask that. But, you know, that was a common question, like, what's a challenge that you had in your current job? And we had a girl who came in, I mean, literally a girl, she was 23 or 24 years old, kid, and she had been working at a large SIU in New Jersey she had 3 years of solid SIU experience, was recommended by her manager from the plan, we worked with them. And when she came in for the interview, one of the questions was, what was one of your biggest challenges in your current job that you've had to overcome? And I think typically a question like that lends itself to either a new case that was complex that I'd never dealt with. Maybe it was a personality conflict with a coworker or a manager. And her response was complex math. And we kind of looked at her and went, what? She says, well, you know, when I'm working with spreadsheets, I sometimes have to deal with complex math. And we thought that was kind of a really weird answer to give. Like, how is complex math something that is a challenge? It was a very weird answer to the question. So, you know, needless to say, we passed on her, because it's not really a challenge that we felt was appropriate for the response. But, you know, obviously, I think part of the metric when you're talking to people who are trying to get into this space or government or what have you is to try to talk to people that are currently in the roles, right? It's sort of like the old adage of, don't dress for the job you have, dress for the job you want. It's a little bit of a similar thing. But, you know, one of the things that we're seeing, you know, as we move on into the kind of the SIU world, and we see this a lot when we deal with the UPICs, we see this a lot on the plan side, because a lot of the people come over from the UPICs. A lot of this is a combination of institutional knowledge and then just expectations that aren't realistic. And so, Matt, that's an important piece of it. I can tell you, I speak to people that are on the banana peel at the OIG ready to retire, or people that have just retired and are looking to find their next career or whatever it may be. And I think that oftentimes people have an expectation that their financial value is substantially greater than what it actually is. And I can't tell you how many times when I've spoken to people that are retiring from the OIG, and they will bring up, you know, about getting another job, and they'll say, well, you know, I think I can get $150,000 or $160,000 as an SIU investigator, because I have 25 or 30 years at the OIG and I know healthcare fraud. And my response is, at $160,000, you're going to be the director of the SIU, and you're never going to get a job as the director of the SIU as a line investigator. And so that becomes the other challenge, is these expectations. And I can tell you, there's another anecdote here. You know, we're trying to do some hiring here. We've got some positions in the SIU, some data analyst positions. And sometimes the amount of money that people are asking for, in the interviews are just mind-boggling amounts of money. And we know, for example, in the UPIC world, when we interview people who are at a UPIC looking to come here, and we ask them what their salary expectations are, and we have a general sense what the UPIC salaries are. You were at a UPIC for years as the director. Jason was at the UPIC for years as the director. We have another person here who is the Southeast director. We know what the salary ranges are. And so when people come to us and give us these ridiculous numbers, it's just that, you know, you wind up locking yourself out of even being considered for a position because you're not even being reasonable. I mean, how do you even deal with that, right? I mean, from a personnel perspective, filling positions and people's expectations are way above what they really should be.
Yeah, in a word, it's difficult because, you know, the way the UPICs are structured, you know, your staffing is based on your budget, and your budget was established when you put in for the contract and won it. And the margins that you work with are very small in terms of profitability. And so you have to find the most qualified people at the lowest possible cost, because you either have to reduce staffing to have more expensive people or have more people at lower cost. And there's no going over budget. There's none of that, because you have to stay within the budget that was established 5 years ago when you won the contract. And it's very difficult. And, you know, what makes it more difficult is a lot of the UPICs, they're owned by a parent company, and it's their HR folks that run the recruiting. So, and no matter how many times you explain what you need and things like that, they don't always quite understand. So the recruits that you get are not always aligned with the needs, and they don't fully understand the budget rules that the UPICs are following, because the parent company might have different types of contracts. They don't understand the cost plus contract that the UPICs work under. And so that, you know, so they're making these assumptions on the types of people and the salaries that aren't aligned with what the UPICs have to do. And the third complication is CMS has metrics in place. So you have to make these numbers in terms of, you know, numbers of leads developed, numbers of cases developed, all of these things, you know, while at the same time trying to hire people that you're able to find to make those numbers. So you've got to find people. You can't make that decision up front like Wade did with, do I go with the young, fresh person that we have to train, or do I go with an experienced person? You don't have the time at a UPIC to take somebody green and run them up, because they've got to make their numbers right away. So there's all those complicating factors. So what, you know, we would get hundreds of resumes, same as the IG, and it's, you know, we have to quickly go through them. Some of the things that we did to test literally was to test these people, like a data analyst, we give them a data test as part of their interview. If it was an investigator, we'd give them hypotheticals as part of their interview to see if they could answer them and give us an investigative plan and things like that. And then try to find that balance between experience and expectations. And I can't tell you how many times we had to tell, a retiring OIG agent, yeah, you were a great Street 13, but to be a manager in the UPIC, you have to have the qualifications set by CMS as to the numbers of years of supervisory experience. You don't have that. So the best you can do is start as an investigator, and here's the salary range. And there's really no going above that unless we get rid of somebody else and you do two people's jobs. And that's what it came down to. So, you know, we had to just find the best we could at these salaries that are barely competitive. I'd say fairly, but probably more closely to barely competitive, which lends to turnover. You know, going back to all of those problems with, you know, the metrics and getting people on board. So it was a never ending issue for at least when I was at the UPIC to hire people, especially in specific labor categories like data analysts and data scientists. The salaries we were able to offer were not competitive to what other firms could.
And that's really the big challenge. And I know, you know, what we've been doing here at Advise is, I'll call it taking a chance, but it's not really as much taking a chance. But, you know, we originally had a staffing plan that was really only people that were very seasoned investigators, right? Our team has, we've got people outside of the three of us. We've got, you know, we've got some other OIG people, prior law enforcement, federal law enforcement, who did healthcare fraud in their prior jobs. And we made a tectonic shift a couple of years ago and hired on some people who were very, very junior, right? Who really their only base of experience was that they had done internships in healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse. So they had just enough knowledge to be workable, but not so experienced that they were out of the price range. And that's been very successful for us because we've been finding that when we combine our really seasoned professional investigators with our newer and very junior investigators, that blend creates, from a budget perspective, it creates obviously a better budget for us to be able to operate effectively and efficiently, but also gives people who are looking to get into this line of business an opportunity to come in and get trained and be taught how to do it. And it not being like in the BUCA world where you're one of 400 people or 500 investigators. And that's, you know, and that's worked for us. But, you know, what we're seeing is the big challenge is that when you've worked for another plan and you've had a long history with that plan and you're making a lot of money, or we'll call it a lot of money, but you're getting paid well at that plan, and you have 20 years experience, and we're looking for someone with 2 to 5 years experience. And when we ask about what your salary requirements are, and you're giving me a salary requirement based upon 20 years, I can respect that. But if the job requirement is we're looking for someone in the 2 to 3 year range or the 2 to 5 year range, you can't, and it's not a leadership role, you can't expect to get the salary that you were making in your prior role. If you're looking to, whether it be that you're leaving by your own choosing, or in some cases you're leaving by someone else's choosing, you know, if you've got 20 years of experience, and we're finding that now, we're trying to fill a data analyst role, and it's a junior role, 2 to 5 years experience, and we've got people applying with 20 years of really solid data analytics experience, and their resumes are amazing. And when they're asking for literally twice what we're able to pay, and we go to them and we say, you're twice what our budget is. And they say, well, I've got 20 years experience. It's like, I understand that, but you can't sell yourself on a job that's in the 2 to 5 year range where this is what our budget is. Our budget is what it is. We can't pay you twice what our budget is. It just doesn't work. You know, it's like saying I must have money in my bank account because I still have checks in the checkbook. Right? Like you got to cover what you can cover. And so for us, if we've got a situation where someone wants twice the amount of money than what our budget allows, you've got to say to the person, like, you're out of our budget. Sorry. And we've actually had a couple of people where we do that and they've come back and they've recalibrated. So it's, you know, it's a discussion, and we're happy to have those discussions. But in the broadest sense, you know, when you go work at the OIG and you get hired as a GS 7, 9, 11, 12, whatever that role is, you're being hired based upon the level of experience that's being sought for the position, and the salary range is commensurate with that. And similarly, when you're trying to get a job in SIU, in the commercial or the private sector, it's got to be commensurate. You know, so the story, kind of the postscript is we're trying to fill some roles, and we've been reaching out to some people, and we had an individual respond back on an email saying that he had a lot of friends that are in government right now who are eligible to retire, and they're not because they're afraid about what the SIU job market looks like. And so they're hanging on as long as they can because they're seeing that the SIU job market, you know, when you've got plans cutting positions and it's affecting the SIU space, or they're seeing that they're not getting a salary that they think they're going to get. And I'm not really sure where people's salary thoughts come from. You know, when I talk to people from the OIG that are getting ready to retire, and they give me these wild numbers that they think that they're going to be able to get, and I say to them, where are you getting this from? And they don't really give any sort of background as to where they're getting that number from. It's just kind of a made-up number. you've got to be able to recalibrate, you know, where that number is and where the, you know, where that number is right. But, you know, we're seeing these tectonic shifts in the industry. When we have a posting for a position, we're getting 400, 500, 600 resumes from people. And most of them aren't even borderline qualified because they don't have any prior healthcare experience, or people that have, like, for example, you know, we're looking for a data analyst right now who have no data analytics experience in healthcare. And that's what we're looking for. We're saying 2 to 5 years experience, and it's got to be in healthcare. You get people who have no healthcare experience, and the I'm a fast learner, which is my favorite phrase. I'm a fast learner. I think anybody who's looking for a job is a fast learner. That's why you're looking for a job, and you're going to say that you're a fast learner. But I think it's very important, getting back to, you know, to Wade, is your resume is the number one start. You know, when we look at positions on that we're looking to fill on either Indeed or LinkedIn or some of our other sources, we're going through the resumes. You know, I think I went through last week 500 resumes. And of the 500, probably 475 were for people that didn't meet the basic requirements of the job that we had posted, either in the number of years or in prior healthcare experience, or even something as simple as green card holder or citizenship, right? Some of our government contracts, you have to be a permanent resident or a citizen. And I can't tell you how many applications we've gotten from people who are here on student visas, who want us to sponsor them and what have you. We just, you know, we're just not in a position to do that. And the job description clearly says that that's not something that we're considering. So, you know, a little bit of it is you got to apply for jobs that you are going to meet the qualifications for and then kind of go through. But wait, I want to give you kind of the last piece of this is if you were giving advice to someone who was looking to enter into the SIU space, what are some of the, you know, give me the top handful of skills. And remember, I think for people that are looking to get into this space that may not be experienced in it, there's knowledge and there's skills. You can have knowledge of something but not have actually done it practically. You can take a course and have knowledge of something, but the difference between knowledge and skill is that you've done it, you've performed it, you've succeeded at it, and knowledge is something that you have, obviously, a textbook or theoretical knowledge of something. What do you think of the handful of skills that someone should have when applying for a position in an SIU or a healthcare fraud related role?
I think you ran into this recently, but I think we probably make the assumption that most people that are applying for these jobs have a certain skill or experience level with the tools that we use. They have to know how to use Excel. They have to know how to use, you know, Word. They have to know how to, you know, use email, those types of things that I think we kind of make the assumption that most people have that. And we found out that some people don't as much as we kind of assume they would. So I think that's kind of a baseline that, again, we make the assumption, and that kind of has to be there. Beyond that, I think there's a certain, trait, I guess I would call it, for as far as an investigator who's inquisitive, who likes to, you know, figure out things. I don't want to say they're like necessarily puzzle, you know, workers, but they like to figure out, they get a set of circumstances or facts, and they have to, you know, like we've talked about before, come up with an investigative plan. And there's a certain kind of mindset that goes with that. And I think that's really important. You can sometimes pull those people, kind of set them in a different category. Someone who is just looking for a job. They really haven't had any history with doing healthcare fraud or really any interest in it, but they need a job and, you know, they're applying to everything. I think it's easy to separate those people out from the kind of investigator at heart kind of people. And I think that's an important trait to have along with those other kind of skills that you need on the program side of things. But I think that is a big difference, you know. Granted, you know, somebody might have come from another field. We had OIG agents who were not, you know, pre-law or criminal justice. They came from, you know, history majors, music majors, whatever. And that's fine, as long as at the time that they're applying for that job, this is what they want to do. And it's not just like, I need to get a paycheck, so I'll go through the motions and do this. They have to have kind of the want to work these type of cases. And I think again, you can't tell that much from the resume, but when you start talking to people and you throw some of those questions out, like Matt had mentioned, you can kind of tell who's kind of in it for the, they want to do this kind of work, as opposed to someone who just needs to get a paycheck. That's really not who you want to bring on, because then they're not going to last. And then, you know, when you have to re-announce the job and retrain all your, you're going back to ROI again, all your ROI goes down the drain, because you have this dead spot where you bring someone on for a couple weeks or a couple months and they don't work out, and you're back to the drawing board. So again, in the interview, I think you can pull that from some of the candidates and find out who really has an interest and kind of the background for doing those types of investigations.
Yeah, and I think that you know, the folks you mentioned earlier about, you know, we hired them when they were just interns. They had some of those skills, the Excel skills and things like that. But what we also saw were those traits. We saw the curious mind, the ability to deductive reasoning and logic, and the desire to solve those puzzles and synthesize the facts into a case. And right. I think the success of those folks is because of the combination of those skills and knowledge.
Yeah, and I think from my perspective, one of the things that I think becomes a detriment when I look at someone's resume and they have no groundwork for having been someplace for more than a year or two. I mean, I can't tell you how many resumes I've looked at where people are staying at a company for a year or 18 months and they're going somewhere else. And while I can appreciate that, because you may be going somewhere after a year or 18 months and you're getting a substantial pay increase or something, because at the end of the day, you know, everybody wants to earn as much as they possibly can, right? I mean, you want to make money, and that's why people are working. But it does concern me when I look at a resume and I see that somebody's been in the workforce for 10 years and they've had 12 jobs, you know, where they've literally not stayed at a job for more than a year in at least two occasions, right, or something along those lines. So that, you know, that's always something that you have to consider. And I think just more globally, when you're applying for a job, you should understand what some of the skill sets are that are required to do the job. You know, we had somebody that was hired here to be an auditor, a certified professional coder. And after about a week, we learned that the person did not know how to use Excel, had no functional clue of how to use Excel. And so we couldn't keep them, because Excel is a foundational piece of the puzzle. We're not saying we need people who have the ability to be high-end users of Excel, power users, but basic Excel skills are obviously a piece of the puzzle. And when we were dismissing this person from the position, they took offense to the fact that during the interview, they weren't asked if they knew Excel. And I thought it was mind-boggling that I thought that we would have to ask such a question in an interview with someone who's working as an FWA auditor, working in this environment where Excel is a staple. It's kind of like someone who's been in an SIU in healthcare and having to ask them if they know what a CPT code is. You just don't ask those questions because they're inherent in the position. But as a result of that, every single time that we're conducting interviews now, we're having to ask these very basic questions. Do you know how to use Microsoft Office? How are you with Excel? How are you with Word? How are you with using email? Questions that you would never think you'd have to ask, but that you have to ask now. So understanding what the skill sets are for the position are pieces of the puzzle that you should know. If you're going to get a job at an SIU and it's an entry-level job, no one is saying that you necessarily have to know all of the vernacular, but you should at least understand what some of the job skills are going to be. Written communication ability, oral communication ability are two of the biggest ones. And if you're looking to come into something fresh out of college, talk about papers you've written and grades that you've gotten from having written good papers or oral presentations that you've made or things like that, where those pieces of the puzzle can transcend from one kind of job skill to another. Will sort of help to get that metric. So it's, you know, unfortunately, I think for people that are trying to get into this market, sometimes I think people are looking for either more money than is out there, or they think that there's more money to be made, but also sometimes it's understanding and being able to have the transference of skills that do exist with people, but they just don't have that necessarily that realization that those skills are actually transferable. So it's an interesting landscape. We're seeing it a lot from people that are applying for jobs here. We're seeing it a lot from our SIU partners. Oddly enough, we're helping with recruiting to fill roles for some of our payer partners, where we do sort of SIU supportive work. We're not actually running the SIU. We provide some logistical support, but we've got a couple of plans that are asking us to help staff positions because they're having challenges in finding the right people. So they're asking us to help with our network to help fill these roles, because finding the right people is sometimes a challenge. So it's a tough landscape. There are jobs out there. You just need to be able to make sure you've got, as Wade says, have that resume targeting those things and be reasonable in what your salary expectations are and where you think that fits into what your either negotiation is or what you're willing to accept. So for everybody out there looking, good luck, right? Yep. Keep your resume updated. Read job descriptions carefully. Apply for jobs that are within your wheelhouse or jobs that you think are in your wheelhouse. It may not be, but think it's in your wheelhouse, because, you know, as Wayne Gretzky says, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So you got to sometimes take those shots. And we'll see. We'll see where these things go. Hopefully the market will open up. I don't think it's an economy. I don't think it's a, you know, people talk about the economy being terrible, or some people say it's great. I don't think it's really an economy issue. I think it's just that sometimes plans are coming to the determination that fraud, waste, abuse is kind of an adjunct or a tangential piece of the plan operations. And so when budgets get cut, I think oftentimes, unfortunately, SIU operations tend to be the first thing that get looked at. So we'll keep up with everything, and we'll see where this goes. So as always, thanks very much for tuning into this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable. Again, our newsletter every Friday, advise@advizehealth.com. You can get it delivered right to your inbox. We've got some great LinkedIn Lives coming up, and we are quickly approaching our 100th consecutive episode of the OIG Roundtable. We're going to have some pretty exciting and fun things coming up for that. And that'll be in the next couple of weeks. We're getting very close to that as we hit October already. And as always, we thank everybody for tuning in, and we'll see you guys on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you all.
Thank you.